Welcome to the Retail Tech Podcast. My name is Darius Bassefi. I am the host and producer of podcasts, and we speak with people that are experts and players in the retail space. This includes technology as well as other factors that impact the lives of retailers. So today I am speaking with Harry Mosher, founder and CEO of a nonprofit, I believe, called Reshoring USA. And Harry can correct me if I said anything incorrectly there, but I'm really interested in this topic because what we've learned as a part of the pandemic is the heavy reliance of us, in at least in the U.S., on really critical products that are supposed to be coming from the overseas, and if something happens and the supply chain gets distracted or disrupted, we are at a big risk. As well as my personal passion is the impact to the environment, and we're going to be talking about these and other important ideas. So welcome, Harry.
Thank you, Darius. The one correction I would make is, yes, we are a nonprofit, and it is the Reshoring Initiative. That is the name of the group.
Oh, okay. So the Reshoring Initiative. Thank you for that correction.
No problem.
So let's start with a background on maybe yourself, and how did you come about starting the Reshoring Initiative?
So a background, I grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, right across the river from New York City. And the biggest thing in town was Singer's. Her mother, grandmother, somebody had a Singer. And in its day, the factory in Elizabeth had 5,000 workers. It was 2.5 million square feet. It was the largest factory of any kind in the world. My dad ran a third of it. My grandfather was a foreman. I worked there summers. And I went past 20 years ago, and nothing was made there anymore. And as far as I can tell, no Singer products are made in the United States. Everything's imported. And I thought about my career, in which I sold manufacturing equipment, CNC machine tools, foundry equipment, things like that. And company after company, industry after industry, that I wanted to sell the equipment to went out of business, driven out of business by imports. And so I said, somebody's got to do something about this. And I had been running a fairly large company, and I retired in 2010 and founded the Reshoring Initiative.
So personal experience, that's the best kind of experience.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good example. Going from the largest manufacturing facility in the world to non-existent, pretty much, in, 30 years?
Well, it was the largest factory in the world in maybe 1910, or something like that. And it was gone in probably 1980. Or something, or 80 or 90. So, but still, huge number of jobs, and not just the jobs at the factory, but all the people who supplied them with material and, steel and components, and, the people that cooked hamburgers for them and so on. All that disappeared when that factory went out of business.
Right. So I think there is actually a number for every, factory worker, there are X number of support people?
Yeah, there's two numbers that are bounced around. One, people talk about the multiplier effect, and that's generally looking at the economy, the GDP, something like that. And the other one is the number of jobs. And the numbers depend a lot on where you are in the supply chain. So for example, if it's an auto assembly plant, there's 7 or 10 other workers not at the assembly plant making the steel and the components and the engines and the tires and the glass, everything else that feeds into that. Whereas if it's a company that's making, let's say they're stamping out silverware, you know, stainless flatware, well, then there's a steel supplier and maybe somebody who makes the tool or something like that, but there isn't anywhere near as much. So the number of those support jobs within manufacturing can range from, you know, one maybe up to 7 or 10. But then the total impact on the economy can range again from 1 or 2 up to, you know, 6, 7, depending on the industry under consideration.
Right. Yeah. And probably an extreme example on the other end is something like Boeing, that there's probably a much larger multiplier.
Because there's so many components coming in from outside. And you know, just to play into our theme, Boeing, I think with the Dreamliner, you know, the one that came out, 10 years ago or something, at first they had horrible problems because they had decided to outsource to other companies and offshore outside the country a huge amount of the components and even some of the design responsibility. And when the components came in, they didn't fit together because they hadn't coordinated it well enough. It was being done at such a distance. And they had to bring much of that component manufacturer back into Boeing to get control so that the pieces would go together. And so it's an example of the disadvantages and disruption that can happen with widely distributed sourcing.
Yeah, I guess they learned the hard way that building an airplane is a little more complicated than putting together a laptop.
I think so.
and eventually, at some point, there will probably, you know, there will be a way to get there, but we're far from that time right now. So let's talk about what is the reshoring initiative.
So reshoring initiative is a nonprofit, and our mission is to bring 5 million manufacturing jobs to the U.S. from offshore, a combination of reshoring, which is done by U.S. companies, think General Motors, for example, and FDI, foreign direct investment, which is done by foreign headquartered companies, think Toyota. But in both cases, when they choose to manufacture the component or the product in the U.S. for the U.S. market, instead of shipping it here from somewhere else, they're doing so because they decide they're going to be better off, that they'll be more profitable by doing so. So the logic is the same for reshoring and FDI. So our job is to bring 5 million of those jobs back, and we pick 5 million because that's the number that it will take to balance the goods trade deficit. Again, the trade deficit is the difference between our imports and our exports. So we import 900 billion with a B more than we export, and it will take about 5 million U.S. manufacturing workers at current levels of productivity to produce that amount of goods. So that's our objective. The way we do it, we document the trend. So we're the only source of data on the trend. So if a listener wants to find what kind of products are being reshored by what companies, to what states, from what countries, for what reasons, you can find all of that for free on our website, reshorenow.org. And so we document it, we promote it. I'm doing this today, and I'll do 70 or 80 podcasts and webinars and conferences this year around the country. And we do write an article or two a month. We get interviewed for the print media, you know, once or twice a month, and then we enable it. So we have tools to help brands or manufacturers or retailers make smarter sourcing decisions. So right now, the tendency for those companies is to say, where can I buy it for less? And if I can buy it, say, in China for 7, and it's going to cost me 10 in the U.S., pretty black and white decision, get it in China or India, wherever, you know, wherever that cheaper price is. And we say, no, that's not the right way to do it. You have to consider not just the FOB or ex works price, but also the the duty and the freight and the carrying cost of inventory, the chance of stocking out, the quality differential, the value of a made in USA label, which in some cases can be quite important. ESG considerations, environmental, social, corporate governance. Because when you produce the product in the U.S., instead of making it somewhere else and shipping it here, especially if it is reduced by 25% or more. So there's a whole series of reasons like that. And our TCO estimator helps the companies quantify all those considerations, and so they can make a bottom line decision.
So, I think the concept itself, and you know what you explain, is not really hard to understand. So, that's one of my questions: is that how do people actually only look at the cost of labor when they think about offshore manufacturing, when it's so easy to understand all the other factors?
I'd say when they put a factory somewhere, they typically look at the cost of labor. If they're buying a piece of clothing, an appliance, pots and pans, something from, say, a Chinese vendor or a U.S. vendor, they look at the FOB price or the ex-works price. And one reason they do that is it's a big piece of the total cost, like 70 or 80%, and it's a hard, firm number, you know, except for maybe changes in currency or something like that. But basically, it's a hard, you know, it's a rock. You know what it is. Because if that procurement person has to start making decisions about the political instability risk of the other country, or the natural disaster risk, or the probability of stocking out, or how much overstock will we have, or the value of a made USA label. Well, those are more subjective. Those require a lot more analysis and study. And so the tendency has been for the MBA types to parachute into the companies, look at what's being done, say, we can save millions by buying that in China, India, Mexico, somewhere. And they get a bonus for doing so, buying the lowest price, even if they've not bought the lowest total cost. And so the culture has supported going for the lowest price. And so our challenge is to get the board of directors, the CEO, you know, whomever, the vice president at the company, say, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to look at the total cost. We're going to consider all the factors that should be considered.
Yeah, that's an important thing I want to come back to, is education. I want to talk about, are even universities and MBA programs even talking about the impact and the true costs of offshore manufacturing? Before we do that, I want to ask you, so 5 million is the goal. In what time frame? Is there a timeline target?
It'd be nice if we got it done while I'm still alive.
Well, that extends it out about 100 years. Come on.
So I think realistically, first let's put it in perspective. When we started, and I don't think I mentioned this, when we started in 2010, in that year, 6,000 jobs were announced coming back. And last year, 2020, in that year, 160,000 were announced. And this year, we think 200 to 240,000 jobs announced coming back. But at the same time, there were some jobs being offshore. There were still companies moving some work to China, Mexico, et cetera. Not as fast as they were 15 years ago, but still some loss, some leakage that way. So we'd say we need to get our 150, 200,000 a year up to 300,000 or so, 400,000, and keep it there for 10 or 15 years to get to the 5 million. And the one reason it'll take that long, two reasons. First, you have to build factories and buy equipment, because as most of you know, most U.S. factories right now are running flat out. That's why you can't get the chips and the steel and the aluminum and all this other stuff that plastics, all these kind of things that are needed. Everybody's running flat out, so there's no capacity for a 40% increase. That's what we're talking about, a 40% increase in U.S. manufacturing. And so we have to build more factories, buy more equipment, and most difficult, we have to convince more, let's say, high school students that that there's a better solution of going into an apprenticeship and becoming a toolmaker or a machinist, a welder, a chemical technician, something like that, rather than going on to university and studying sociology, anthropology, you know, what have you. Because the by going into that skilled, what people call trades, I call professions, you avoid the tuition, you avoid the debt, you start making money immediately in the apprenticeship, and over most of the life of the career, that person will make more than the average, at least liberal arts graduate will. I did a study. I compared toolmakers, a toolmaker apprentice to a history graduate, and I had the data as a function of number of age and how much they were making. And at the age of 49, the toolmaker should have a net worth $1 million higher than the history major. But the guidance counselors don't show that to kids because the guidance counselor and the high school are measured by what college, what universities, and how and what percentage of the kids go to university from their high school, not by how many 10 years later have a really good job.
Okay, yeah, I guess that's the those are the incentives that are really important in getting anything moving forward, is what's the incentive for people. Everybody
have to get that information out to the students, to the guidance counselors, the parents, so they see that there is a very good alternative.
Yeah, this reminds me, where I live in Orange County, California, one of my neighbors was a teacher, rest his I guess he passed away a few years ago, great friend. He was a teacher at the local college in the shop. And he said basically about 10 years ago, they just closed it down because they couldn't have enough students going there. Everybody wants to go into software and sales and business, and nobody wants to do work with their hands anymore. Yeah. So,
well, that's because that's not played up as a interesting thing to do.
It's not sexy. Yeah.
It
used to be
sexy.
In the days of the Fonz, it used to be sexy, but now it's...
I have this, since we're talking retail, I have this image of strip malls near in residential communities, and with the cutback in the needed square footage of retail, of those strip malls being converted into small, clean, high-tech manufacturing facilities, CNC machine shops, things like that, and the workers who used to sell products in the retail and live near the stores, bicycling to work, and then working in the factory making the products they used to sell.
That's amazing. I love that image, vision. And yeah, I mean, with CNC and I guess the new form of CNC called 3D printing. Yeah, I think that's very interesting.
Yeah. And if you compare the U.S., say, to Europe, and I've worked for European companies a lot of my career, and I've been there 60 or 70 times, and the in beautiful towns, you know, like medieval kind of towns, the kind of place you'd go to for as a tourist, you'll see beautiful homes, and right next door to the home, a company. It could be even a 500 or 1,000 person company, very clean, and the high school kids ride their bicycle to the factory to do the apprenticeship. Their parents walk or bicycle to the job. Everybody's a good neighbor. In comparison to here, where we put factories in one location and homes in another, and then people have to commute 20, 30, 40 miles to get from one place to the other. So especially in this time of consideration for global warming, climate, etc., and getting the job near the worker has a lot of value.
So just to confirm on the numbers, really what's important is not just the jobs that are getting started here, but what's important is the net, right? What you're looking is the net change difference per year. So like if we get 100,000 new jobs coming here and 200,000 go out at the same time, that doesn't help.
No, let's say it's better than 200 going out and none coming here.
It is, but
if you went back to the period from, say, around 2000 when China joined the WTO until 2010, then our trade deficit grew the most rapidly, and there was a lot of offshoring going, lots of factories closing, you know, town after town getting decimated by that, and not much coming back. And now what's happened since then is that the rate of jobs coming back has gone up dramatically, as I described, and the rate of, especially of factory closings and work moving offshore, has gone down substantially. So as an example of this, we did a regression analysis. So you put the dots on the paper and you draw a line through them, you know, that fits the dots best. And if someone in 2010 had predicted what the U.S. manufacturing employment would be, and you compare that to what it actually is today, it's actually 4 or 5 million higher than one would have predicted 10 or 15 years ago, because we've been losing the jobs much less rapidly than we used to, and we've been bringing them back much more rapidly.
Okay. Yeah.
So we're going the right direction. Let's say we're about neutral, you know, and we need to go strongly positive. But it's to get those 5 million workers, to get 5 million more high school kids to decide on manufacturing as the beginning of their career instead of just going off to university, that's going to take a lot of cultural change. And so it's going to take 10 years, it's going to take 20 years to make it happen.
Okay, let's talk about education now. Is anybody teaching any of this information in universities or colleges?
No, what I describe, let's say I have spoken at Ohio State University a couple times, and at Georgia State, and maybe 4 or 5 others, either live or remotely. So I've had some presentations to supply chain departments, and I'd say most the professors would all know the term total cost of ownership, but it's not high on most of their priorities for teaching. So it's if I had the time, I would do a really good videotape and get it out, offer it to all of them to use as one of their classes. But I haven't done that yet. But that'd be a good thing to do. We do have video. We do have archived webinars that deal with total cost of ownership and make the case on why and how companies should use it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it seems to me this probably needs to even be more focused towards the MBAs and the business people.
MBAs who maybe make the decisions. But the MBAs, but also the supply chain people, because some of them become the VP supply chain or something like that, and they're going to have something to say about it. Also, the accountants, because, you know, the accountants, U.S. companies and chief financial officers are known for their myopic focus on this quarter's financial results. You know, did we beat the Wall Street estimate kind of thing for earnings per share? And when you switch from offshore to domestic sourcing, there's some one-time costs. You have to move tooling, maybe people, you know, maybe you have to build a new factory. You build up some inventory before you do the transition. So all kinds of things that the chief financial officer would prefer not to see. So we need the supply chain people, the MBAs, the accountants, all to understand that for the long term, what we're describing is often the best choice for their companies.
What about like the manufacturing associations in the U.S.? Are they involved in what you're doing? Are they supporting you?
The small ones are. The NTMA, National Tooling and Machining Association, the AME, Alliance for Association for Manufacturing Excellence, people like that are. We've gotten the biggest by AMT, Association for Manufacturing Technology, the people who make the machine tools and things like that. They've been very, very, very supportive. The one that should be more supportive is NAM, National Association of Manufacturers, which is the gorilla, the 800-pound gorilla in manufacturing. And they occasionally talk about reshoring. They'll say, yes, reshoring is a good idea kind of thing. But I've approached them repeatedly to offer our services out to their members and to document the success of their members reshoring and give NAM the political power that it would get from showing that its members were bringing jobs back to the U.S. And I can't get them to actually act aggressively on the subject.
What do you think is the reason?
You never know what's in someone else's mind, but I suspect that they have these, especially these big companies that are their members, and the big companies now have based their supply chain model significantly on importing large amounts of product and selling it in the United States, and to get them to change that model, to go back and build factories here again, to hire people to, you know, redesign the product to produce it here, find supply chains here, to go through all that, and to have the four or five times higher labor costs here that they went away from by going there, that those companies perceive that not as their self-interest, and therefore NAM tends to promote the self-interest of those companies, where I'd say they should be promoting the interest of the factories and the factory workers of the towns where the manufacturing is actually taking place, and convincing their member companies that if they do the math correctly, if they make the right decisions, that the company will also benefit. So one thing that I was pleased by, there's a group called the Business Roundtable. Like 180, 200 of the top CEOs in the country. And they signed a statement in August of 2019 that said that whereas in the past, the only stakeholder for the company, it was the shareholder. Everything had to be done to maximize for the shareholder. And these 180 executives signed a statement saying that now that's no longer true. Yes, the shareholder, but also community, suppliers, and employees. And so every time I get a chance, I call on them and say, the best thing you can do to demonstrate that is to reshore, is to bring work back to the communities where it used to be, to the workers who used to have jobs, to the suppliers that used to sell you the components and the raw materials. So I'll take this opportunity again to call on those companies to what I'll call walk the talk.
Okay, that's good. I'll make a note of that because I personally want to get more active on this topic, and we'll talk offline how, you know, I can probably help. But I think it's too important to just sit on the sidelines and let things happen. Sorry, go ahead.
One thing I want to make sure we get into, I have a fair amount of data. So far, we've been talking largely about why it's in the interest of the country, of the employee, of the community, that reshoring happened. But I've got some excellent information on why it's in the interest of the retailer to source more product in the U.S. rather than what they're doing today. So whenever you want to go into that, I'd be delighted to do that.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go into it right now.
Okay. So we've dug deeply into apparel, especially because it's one of those areas it has been the weakest in the U.S. Like 97% of apparel and footwear sales are imported in the United States. So it's one of the things that went away first, and it is coming back, but it's not easy. But a lot of our data comes out of the apparel sector, and the kind of things that should influence the retailer and the brand are, for example, that when you have local sourcing, you can order your quantities later. You can order, if you want to have stuff in November, you can maybe order it in September instead of in January or February and still have it available. So you can wait until you start to see what size, what material, what color, what whatever is most popular, and then adapt your ordering to the actual demand of the marketplace. Something that relates to that is that in the United States, total losses due to a combination of overstocking, in other words, having excess inventory, which then has to be marked down dramatically, so overstocking or stocking out, not having the product when the customer comes in to buy it, the total losses due to that is on the order of $250 billion, that's with a B, $250 billion per year. And so you can afford to pay moderately more for the product if you can eliminate most of that $250 billion by fitting your demand, your supply, to much more closely to the demand. Some other things that should be influential: the Made in America concept. Survey after survey says that consumers, 50-60% of them, would prefer to buy a Made in America product. They believe the quality is higher. They feel good about buying something made in America. Many of them, 20-30%, will pay 10-20% more, depending on what it is. And yet they don't do it as often as the surveys would say. And I think the main reason is because it's so hard to find. You know, if I'm in a typical retailer or a home improvement place, and say I'm looking for a hammer and I want to find the Made in America hammer, and there's 100 hammers, you know, how many hammers am I going to have to turn over to hopefully find a label that tells me which one's Made in America? So I call on retailers. Like if I owned a clothing store, like a small boutique clothing store, like I've been into them to buy something for my wife, and I say, tell me about the things here that are made in the United States. They say, well, you've got to turn all those labels over and look at them and see what they say. We have no idea.
They don't even know.
Not much. So if I owned a store like that, I'd have a big sign up behind the service desk, and it would say, ask us about products made in America. And I'd have the computer would always be able to spit that out, and they'd be able to hand me a list of everything in the store made in America and what it is and roughly where to find it in the store. And I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe if they did that, that more people would ask for it, more people would buy the Made in America product, and the retailer would say, huh, that's interesting. We're selling more Made in America product. Maybe we should stock more Made in America products. I think you can have a sort of a self-fulfilling virtuous cycle if the retailer will get behind the effort and especially make it easy for the customer to find that product. An example of this that I had some participation is with most of you are probably familiar with Walmart. That had started off with their $250 billion Made in America program to increase their purchases of Made in America products by $250 billion over 10 years. And now they've upped that to $350 billion. And I consulted with them in the beginning on that first for a couple of years. I kid that I did it for everyday low consulting fees. And the but they really tried very hard to find the Made in America product. They were somewhat rigid about not wanting to raise the retail price because they're known for their low retail prices. But I've been to their open calls where hundreds of companies come in to pitch products to them. And I've seen company after company pitch and in many cases succeed and get their Made in America product into the Walmart. So I've seen that a big retailer can do that. And I'd say if other retailers did the same thing, that would help to drive the trend.
All right, so just to do a quick reset on the room, we are speaking with Harry Mosher, the CEO of the Reshoring Initiative. And the Reshoring Initiative is about bringing manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. So if anybody has a question, please raise your hand and I will bring you up and we can have a conversation and ask Harry any specific questions that you might have. Harry, so just to be clear, are you promoting against all types of offshoring?
No, no. It would not be efficient for the country to import nothing. And that's what no offshoring would be. It would be importing nothing to be entirely self-sufficient. And that's not feasible because there's minerals and bananas, pineapples, whatever that we don't produce here, so it's impossible to do without some imports, but all we ask is for companies is to do the math correctly, to look at all the relevant costs and risks, and our data on we have data. I took the data on 180 cases of Chinese products where people had used our TCO estimator, and in 8% of those cases, the U.S. had the lowest FOB price, or the factory price. In 32%, the lowest total cost of ownership, and in 46%, the lowest cost if there was also a 15% Trump tariff in place. So we ask companies, do the math. Don't just settle for the lowest FOB price, do the math, figure everything out, and that the company will find that 20-30% of what they're now importing, they can bring back and be just as profitable. It might take a couple of years to work through the transitions and all this kind of thing, so it might keep their profits from growing quite as fast for a couple of years. But think of the goodwill, think of the benefit for the companies. If first think what happens if we continue to let manufacturing decline, and you lose those jobs and all those multiplier effect and support jobs, and you've undercut your consumer base, whereas if you bring back 10 million jobs with good pay, think of those additional consumers who are going to be out there buying the products that you want to sell. So we think it's pretty clear that not to bring everything back, we would never ask that, but that do the math and find the 10, 20, 30% that you can bring back. Now, at the same time, we call on the government to recognize the fact that manufacturing costs in the U.S. are just uncompetitively high, and to take steps to deal with that. But we would recommend much better skilled workforce, like the German apprenticeship programs, get the dollar down by maybe 20%. Dollar's too high because it's the reserve currency. Have a probably have a value-added tax like almost all other countries do, not raise the corporate income tax. So just do some combination of those, especially the skilled workforce, and then over 10 or 15 years, millions of manufacturing jobs will come back because it'll be in companies' self-interest to bring them back.
Yeah, and these are all pretty complex topics. Each one of them. So, I don't want to get political about it, but there is definitely politics in what's happening, And what I see myself, I wasn't born in the US, but I've lived here most of my life. And what I see is almost like a yo-yo effect, is like for 4 years or 8 years, we do something. And then for another 4 years or 8 years, we do the opposite. And then we go back and forth and back and forth. And what we are seeing right now, after at least 40 years of me seeing this, is that we are like so dependent on you know, on outside resources for some even basic stuff, as well as really the damage that we've done to the middle class. I think it used to be that, I mean, this is what I've heard, the middle class was the strength of the United States. And I don't know, like, how you probably know a lot better what, you know, what the picture is on the middle class right now. How is it shrinking? I mean, it's definitely smaller than it used to be, right?
You know, the middle class was significantly hollowed out by the loss of 5 million manufacturing jobs, which were always good-paying manufacturing jobs, and so that loss hurt the middle class, and then the other jobs that supported them, and so, like in Germany, everybody talks about the Mittelstand, which is the small to medium-sized family-owned machine manufacturing companies that support the big companies, and that sector of the economy is exceptionally strong in Germany. Used to be very strong here 40, 50 years ago, but it's gradually declined, primarily because of imports and lack of skilled workforce. So bringing the manufacturing jobs back will significantly strengthen the middle class, reduce income inequality, improve the environment, cut the trade deficit, reduce the budget deficit, because there'll be more people working, more taxes being paid by people and companies, less welfare, etc. So, you know, almost all the things that everybody's fighting about now would be a lot easier if we had those jobs back.
Yeah, so as far as the countries that are involved in, I guess the biggest deficits, we always hear about China, of course. What do you think? I mean, who are the biggest losers, I guess, if I can use that word? I don't know if it's the right word or not.
If my goal is achieved.
Yes.
Okay. So to put the trade deficit into perspective, our goods, you know, goods meaning things, trade deficit is about $900 billion per year. And I think our goods trade deficit with China is 250 or 300 billion per year. So China is, let's say, a third of our total goods trade deficit. But we actually have a goods trade deficit with 9 of our top 10 trading partners. So Germany, Japan, South Korea, I think Canada, Mexico, Italy, France, you know, of the top 10 trading partners, the only one with which we have a trade surplus is the United Kingdom, which has obviously passed its industrial peak. And so it is. China is certainly a piece of this, and they haven't played fair, and they steal the intellectual property. They used to fix their currency, did all kinds of stuff. But against almost all other industrial countries and a lot of the developing countries, we're just not competitive. So that's where we say it isn't just a question of fixing things with China and reducing our trade deficit with China. Because if take China, raise their currency dramatically, or we put import tariffs on their stuff, the work will shift to Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia, South Korea, somewhere. Say. So you need to get the U.S. overall more competitive.
Right. So, I mean, being competitive is not just on the financial side, right? It's not just the value of the dollar. There's other ways to be competitive as well. Like, you know, if Germany is not buying more products from the US, is it just because of the value of the dollar, or is it just that we just don't create that many good products anymore?
Used to. So I came out of machine tools, and it used to me that the biggest machine tool companies in the world were in the United States back in the 1950s, 1960s. And, you know, maybe half of the biggest in the world were here. And then the dollar went up and the dollar went up, and company after company, industry after industry disappeared because they were not able to compete with the imports. And was it just the dollar? And was it also a skilled workforce? Was it lack of innovation? Was it not invested? It was all kinds of things. But U.S. businessmen aren't stupid. If they could have succeeded, they would have succeeded. So we did a survey of manufacturers and distributors and asked them, for the products that you import, why do you import them? And the overwhelming majority said price. We don't go there for quality. We don't go there for innovation. We don't go there for, because we get trips to China or Germany or something. We go there because I can buy the product for less than I can buy it here. And so if we don't overcome that price difference, the companies will continue to go there for the product.
So let's talk about what makes up that price difference and the total cost of, I guess, ownership or manufacturing. So if we start from the labor, what are some of the assumptions that we have, at least in the U.S., that are actually not accurate?
I'm not sure. First, maybe going back to why our costs are higher. Let me answer that first. And it's high labor rates relative to China, India, Mexico, places like that. And, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 times as high. And we have failed to increase our productivity enough to balance off and justify those higher wage rates. So back 10, 15 years ago, U.S. productivity was rising 2-3% per year in manufacturing. And the last 10 years, I think, we've averaged less than 1%, maybe even less than 0.5% per year. And I'd say why? Insufficient capital investment, because the companies aren't busy enough. They're not making enough money. Therefore, they don't invest. Not a good enough skilled workforce. Too high tax rates. So the after-tax return isn't high enough. So high wage rates, insufficient productivity to justify the wage rates.
How do you measure productivity? Is it like the unit production of each employee?
The way it's measured by the government is value added per dollar, or value added per hour of effort. Now there's labor productivity and there's multi-factor productivity. But labor productivity is what I look at. So it's, you know, how many widgets does your worker produce per hour? And the U.S. has stagnated. It's been almost flat for 10 or 12 years. And in contrast, in China, which started with very low productivity, very much handwork, their rate of labor productivity has risen at the rate of 6 or 7% per year for the last 10 or 15 years. That has balanced off about half of their rising wage rates. So their wage rates have been going up at 10 to 15% per year, expressed in their currency. And maybe half of that has been eliminated by the fact that they've been raising productivity so fast. Now, why can they do that? At first, they were copying us. Our companies went over there and brought the technology, brought the equipment, brought the engineering for them. But now, if you go, I hear people who go there and they see the Chinese factories, and Chinese factories are newer than ours because they were almost all built in the last 10, 15 years, and many of ours were built 40, 50, 60 years ago. Their engineering in their universities, something like 33% of the university students are engineers, whereas in the U.S., 3 or 5% are engineers. In terms of tool makers, Steve Jobs once said, The reason I don't make the product here in the U.S. is because in the U.S., and he was in some kind of a auditorium, in the U.S., I cannot fill this auditorium with engineers and toolmakers that I need to make the product. Whereas in China, I can fill cities with such people. They have an almost unlimited supply of people with basically good skills that way. Why is that? The Chinese population is still hungry. They go into a field like engineering or tool making where they know they're going to make a good buck, whereas Americans aren't as hungry anymore, and they follow their dream, which often turns out to be
trading,
not the best choice because they can't get a job.
Yeah, people are looking for easy money, you know, like, which is okay, but you know, this is, I think, you know, we need to be thinking about us, not just me, when we make some of these decisions. Otherwise, the us that we also take for granted is going to be gone.
Yep, agreed. It's like, I just remember Spock saying, the good of the many versus the good of the one or the few, when he went in to fix the reactor that was going to blow up.
Right.
A couple other points I want to make. I'm sure we're going to run out of time some here. E-commerce, you know, we're in retail, e-commerce is important. And the nature of e-commerce is that if I order something today, I expect it tomorrow or even today. And if there's a surge in orders like there was on the distribution centers during COVID, all of a sudden the distribution center stocks up. And if the only way to supply it is by surface from China or India, that can be 6 weeks or 8 weeks to get product there. Whereas if it's being supplied from a U.S. factory 100 or 500 miles away, conceivably in a couple of days or a week, they could have more supply. So in an age of e-commerce, local supply enables that last mile delivery that everybody wants. Another thing to think about for retailers out there and brands, Made in America is a nice image, but a stronger image is to promote the actual facility, the actual history of the company and the facility, the actual workers who are making the product, to give the consumer the chance to relate to what's actually being done. So not just that it is made in the United States, but how it's made in the United States, to socially bond with the company and its offering.
Okay, that's very important. Something else that you mentioned to me before, again, going back to the cost, is like right now the cost of labor in China is not, I mean, to the level of one third or even one half of what it is here.
I think one third or one fourth. Obviously, in the U.S., you've got a wage rate in New York City and Chicago and a wage rate in Mississippi. And in China, you have a wage rate in Guangdong and Beijing, and you've got a wage rate 2,000 miles inland. And that can be a factor of two or three difference. And so it's very hard to find the comparables. But I'd say four years ago, China was a fifth of ours, and then it got to a fourth, and now it's maybe a fourth or heading for a third. And there's also differences at the lowest skill level. China might be still a fifth of our wage rate, but at the higher skill level, the experienced toolmaker, the foreman, the factory manager, they can be half or two thirds of our rates. So as the country, as both countries tend to automate and go to higher tech solutions, which are necessary to make our higher wage rates competitive, the comparable Chinese wage rate is closer to our wage rate than it is in a manual operation. So in many ways, there are some trends that are moving in our direction.
Right, right. And I guess one positive thing about that is that they're moving up. It's not us moving down as much.
They're moving up in wage. No question. They're moving up in wage. The U.S. in manufacturing during the, I think, the Great Recession, for a while, U.S. manufacturing wages moved down because there were some excesses that got washed out, especially in the automotive industry. At the peak, the marginal cost of an hour of a low-skilled worker in an automotive assembly plant was $79, you know, at a time when China was paying $2.
Wow.
So 79 can't compete with two, especially when the $2 maybe works harder. So that 79, some of those excesses got knocked out. So for a year or two, average manufacturing wages in the U.S. probably fell or didn't rise. And now that those excesses are largely washed out, wages are going up here. But I think, you know, you read the statistics, I think wages now are going up maybe 3%, something like that, whereas China is still going up, I believe, 10 to 15% per year.
Okay, yeah. So I'm looking at your website. Is there a place on your website or somewhere else that shows us, like, really in a current terms of which companies are actually sending jobs overseas and where, and then which ones are bringing them back to the U.S.?
We have, on our website, we have a list under, like, what is reshoring, and you can drill down and get to a list of all the companies we know of that have done reshoring, foreign direct investment, or what we call kept from offshoring, so a company that was thinking of offshoring and chose not to do so. So we have a list of, you know, thousands of companies that meet that those criteria. And then, yeah, in the library, under advanced search, you can go in and search on different NAICS code industries like transportation, consumer products, apparel, and find all the cases we know of for that product category, and a thumbnail sketch of all the data we've accumulated on the case, and links to all the articles that we found to get even more information.
Okay, yeah, I see there is a spreadsheet that with a link to the 2020 company list.
And
okay. Now, is it, so here I see the name of these companies, but I don't see, like, how many jobs.
We have that in the database, which we do not publish. But one, as I said, one can go to the, if you look in the blue bar at the top, there's a library is one of the items, it's a tab, mm-hmm. and you can drop down to the main reshoring library, and in the third or fourth row in red, advanced search, you click on that, and then there's a filter, so you can filter by company name, industry, country the work came back from, state it went to, reason it came back, time period. So any number of those filters you can apply, and then the system will pull up a thumbnail sketch of each company that met all the filters that you applied.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that's a, you know, a lot of times, you know, people don't appreciate things until they see them in a graphical way. So, you know, that's why a lot of companies do these, like, slides and infographics, and they just bring out, you know, the numbers. They represent the significance of the numbers differently. So I'm thinking that's probably something that I might be able to help with.
That'd be great. We'd love to get help from anybody. I suspect we're going to end pretty soon.
Yes.
I think it's about that time. But I've got these 5 million jobs to bring back. So any brands that are out there, any retailers, any manufacturers, any groups that want to achieve what we want to achieve, which is more manufacturing in the U.S., contact me, come to reshorenow.org. You can email me at info@reshorenow.org. I get the emails and I respond, and I'd love to help you achieve our joint goal.
Awesome. One last question. How many people do you have helping you actually with this?
Of those who are paid, maybe 5 or 6, and they're I'm full time, and they're part time. I say I'm full time unpaid, and they're part time paid. But then I have, I'd say, hundreds of people who send me articles and send me tips and give me ideas. And one really good fellow MIT graduate who volunteered, and he's just helped us redesign the TCO estimator. So Gontram Kenwood, and he just did a great job doing that. And in a month or so, we're going to have a significant revision, making it easier to quantify the qualitative factors in the TCO estimator. So if he happens to hear that, thank you, Gontram.
Awesome. Yeah, that's wonderful. I think that's this is great to hear. Well, thank you so much, Harry. It's really educational for me to speak with you, and I think this is an really important topic. So, look forward to our continued conversations on this.
It was a pleasure. You're a great host, and I enjoyed it very much.